Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, most gracious, most compassionate. We are in Ramadan, the most sacred and most important month in the Muslim calendar. Muslims call Ramadan the blessed month because there are so many potentially blessings in it for the people of faith. Unfortunately, the true spirit of Ramadan is often not fully understood and definitely not fully appreciated in the Muslim community. As I understand it, even for some Muslim folks, Ramadan is a time of religious entertainment. And I'm not saying it lightly. In Iran today, for example, it is becoming more and more fashionable for restaurants to be open and serve their customers until dawn, until Sahari. So observant Muslims these days throw their Sahari parties in fancy restaurants, upscale restaurants. Even the Iranian state TV stations save their best shows for Ramadan. The best TV shows in Iran today, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, are aired in the month of Ramadan. So when people fast for a long day and then they break their fast, they sit in front of their TVs and watch some really nice, relaxing TV programs. The way I understand it, in the Arab world, things are not all that better either. In my opinion, this is absolutely a disservice to Islamic teachings. First and foremost, Ramadan ought to be a time of reflection, a time to slow down the fast pace of daily life, to ponder, to reflect on who we really are and who we ought to really be. It's a time to reflect about our shortcomings, our flaws, and in religious language, our sins. Ramadan ought to be a time for spiritual rejuvenation and spiritual transformation. Tonight, inshallah, I will share with you some thoughts about the spiritual dimensions of Ramadan. I specifically put this presentation together for the young folks in the audience. I will organize my thoughts around three specific fruits of Ramadan. The first one is self-control. The second one is heart and soul purification. And the third one is spiritual transformation. So these are the three spiritual fruits of Ramadan that, inshallah, I will discuss in some length for you tonight. Let me begin my presentation with a story. The story that I want to begin my presentation with comes from the American Indian Cherokee tribe. And I think this story is a very good entry point into what I'm going to share with you tonight. One evening, an old Cherokee Indian told his grandson about a battle that goes on inside people. He said, "My son, the battle is between two wolves inside all of us. One is an evil wolf. It is anger, envy, jealousy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego. The other one is a good wolf. It is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith." The grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked his grandfather, "Which wolf wins?" The old Cherokee simply replied, the one you feed. The one you feed. This story is so simple and yet so profound and so meaningful. Each and every one of us has two wolves running inside us. A good wolf and a bad wolf. The evil wolf or the good wolf is fed every day by the choices we make. Every day when you get out of your home, you go to work, you go to school, you make choices. Every single choice that you make will feed either the good wolf or the evil wolf. We have a choice to make. If we feed the good wolf, it will show up in our character, in our habits and behavior positively. If we feed the evil wolf, it will also show up in our habits and character and behavior, albeit negatively. It will be like a poison, and it will slowly eat away at our soul. There is a verse in the Holy Quran that I believe essentially validates the Cherokee tale of two wolves. And here is the Quranic reference. Chapter 91, verses 7 through 10. Very famous verses in the Holy Quran, very thoughtful and incredibly meaningful. وَنَفْسٍ وَمَا سَوَّاهَا فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَقْوَاهَا قَدْ أَفْلَهَا مَنْ زَكَّاهَا وَقَدْ خَابَ مَنْ دَسَّاهَا. By the soul and how God formed it and inspired it to know its rebellion and piety. The one who purifies his soul succeeds, and the one who corrupts it fails. There are two critical words in these verses. Fujur, in English, it's translated as rebellion, and taqwa, which is translated as piety. The good wolf and the bad wolf. Fujur and taqwa, rebellion and piety, are essentially two universal influences that can impact our soul. These are two opposing influences that our soul can gravitate to. Let me briefly explain what these two influences are. What does fujur or the bad wolf mean? Fujur comes from, in Arabic, comes from the root word fajar, which means to break up, to break up. For example, Arabs call daybreak or dawn fajr. Why? Because light of day breaks out of the darkness of night. Fujur essentially constitutes the human tendency to break moral boundaries. See, there are moral boundaries set for us by all the Almighty, and fujur is our tendency and our negative capacity to transgress, to trespass, to step over these moral boundaries. This is the bad wolf, which causes us to commit wickedness and evil. How about taqwa or piety? Taqwa comes from the root word waqaya in the Arabic language. Waqaya means to protect, to ward off, to guard against. So waqaya is whatever protects from harm. In this building that we are sitting under tonight, the columns are waqaya for this building, because these columns protect the building from falling down. What do you think waqaya is for your car? It's the brakes, right? The brake system in your car is the waqaya. The shield in old times for warriors was considered to be waqaya because it protected the warriors from getting killed in warfare. The human soul also has waqaya. It is the self-control mechanism that God has built into every soul. So, Taqwa essentially is the ability of the soul to resist temptation. It's the ability to resist temptation, to restrain from overstepping ethical boundaries. It is a self-control mechanism, or as I mentioned, it's the good wolf in every single one of us. Even though every soul has waqaya, or this protective mechanism, it needs to be maintained. Our cars, they all have brakes, but we have to maintain them, correct? I'm not a mechanic, but maybe about 10, 20,000 miles, you got to go in and check your brakes. You have to maintain it. You cannot neglect your car's brake system. It's the same with your soul. Even though God has instilled baqaya or taqwa in our soul, it has to be maintained. It has to be worked on. We have to boost our self-control. You have to boost it. As the verse said, if you boost your self-control, you will succeed in life. If you neglect your self-control mechanism, you will fail. Let me share something with you, which I truly believe in that. A lot of us in the modern world are very successful in the academic world. A lot of us are very successful in the business world. We are successful in our careers. But many of us, unfortunately, are failures in life. Do not equate success in business with success in life. So, now let me talk about the first fruit of Ramadan. Now that I've set the stage with that old Cherokee story and these verses from the Quran, let's talk about the first fruit of Ramadan, self-control. So as I mentioned, we all have this thing called taqwa, or self-restraining mechanism, but it has to be boosted. My question to you is this: how can we boost our self-control? As it turns out, the Holy Quran prescribes a very important exercise to Muslims in order to boost self-control. Do you know what that exercise is? Anybody? What is the Quranic prescription for boosting our self-control? Fasting. Fasting. As simple as that. That is the Quranic prescription to every single one of us in order to boost our self-control. In chapter 2, verse 183, it is mentioned, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الصِّيَامُ كَمَا كُتِبَ عَلَى الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ لَأَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. You who believe, fasting is prescribed for you as it was prescribed for those before you, so that you may become pious, so that you can increase your piety. So the ultimate end in Ramadan is to boost self-control. That comes directly from the Holy Quran. For 30 days, we voluntarily subject ourselves to a stringent self-discipline regimen. It is voluntary. Nobody forces us. So voluntarily we impose a stringent discipline on ourselves. We say no to the most basic urges we have. The urge to eat, the urge to drink, so on and so forth. We practice to say no to the very things that our survival depends on. This is, my friends, the best way to build self-discipline. If you can, if you are able to say no to the things that your survival depends on, it should be far easier for you to say no to things that are elective, so to speak. Self-control and self-discipline is critical for practical morality. So let me develop this idea a little bit further. So why is self-control so important? Why is self-discipline so important? Let me diverge a little bit. one of the major flaws that I see in modern thinking, modern upbringing, is the fact that we are taught self-control is actually a bad thing. Did you know that? Isn't that what capitalism is all about? You need to let go and consume whatever you damn please. Don't hinder. Don't just say no to your desires. If you like to have something, go have it. This flies in the face of all world religions. This flies in the face of all spiritual traditions in the world. It flies in the face of Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Rumi, so on and so forth. Because there is no inhibition. You see, the modern lifestyle does not put any value on inhibition. Right? But I'm here to tell you that without inhibition, you cannot be a moral agent. You cannot be a moral human being. And let me tell you why. Self-control and self-discipline, which is part and parcel to Ramadan, is critical for moral behavior. In order to enjoy moral behavior, we must be able to control our ego. If you cannot control your ego, you cannot be a moral person. We have to control our ego. We must be able to say no to the demands of our ego for lying, for deceit, treachery, stealing, trampling over the rights of other people. That's what ego invites us to do, right? You want to get ahead in the business world? Cheat. You want to get ahead in the business world? Practice treachery. Because there is no inhibition, there is no self-control. So, if you want to be a moral person, if you want to be a decent human being, you ought to learn to say no to the demands of your ego. So, in that sense, Ramadan builds moral character. I keep stressing that so that, inshallah, you and I, when we fast, we know that it's all about building a moral character. If we fast for 30 days and our morality tank is very low, it means we have not had a successful Ramadan. On that note, let me share with you some thoughts of a major flaw in the average person's religiosity. This is true of Christianity, this is true of Judaism, Islam, so on and so forth. What is this flaw in the average person's religiosity? The flaw is that there seems to be a disconnect between religious practices, or as we say in Parsi, ibadat, and ethics, akhlaq. There is a disconnect between ethics and religious practices. We are often told from early childhood that we should pray, we should do our religious practices because we are obligated to do that. So we always view religious practices and as obligation. Am I right on that? We are obligated. Why is it an obligation? Because God has given us so many blessings. Right? So we receive these blessings from God, and in order to be thankful, we have to pray to God. So we tend to view prayers and religious practices as a token of appreciation towards God, as a way of saying a thank you to God. I'm here to tell you that's a misnomer. That's not right. It's good for kids, but not for grown-ups. Kids maybe cannot appreciate the deeper meaning of prayers, right? So you have to, you know, in their own way and in their own language, you have to encourage them to engage in prayers. But when we grow up, we need to grow out of things that we learned in childhood. There is a tremendous and a strong connection between every single religious practice we have in Islam and ethics and morality. If you read the Quran from cover to cover, it will become very clear that every religious practice should have tangible and concrete rewards for us here and now, on earth, in this life. not necessarily in the afterlife. Right? So do not think of prayers, fasting, as a ticket to paradise. Right? You should reap some benefits here and now in this life. Now, this doesn't negate heaven. This doesn't negate paradise in the afterlife. Rumi, I think, said it the best. هر که کارد دست گندم بایدش کاه خود اندر تبع می آیدش. Whoever sows is in quest of wheat. The chaff comes to him indeed, but only secondarily. No farmer plants in order to have chaff. They plant seeds in order to have wheat. But secondarily, he will also have chaff in order to feed his animals. Right? So, when we fast, we will have more control over our intentions, our longings, and our actions. Therefore, we will stay within the ethical boundaries. We will be a decent and good human being. That will automatically qualify us for paradise. So you will get there. Even though your prayers will have tremendous benefit for you in this life, because you're going to be more ethical, and because you are ethical, you will have more peace inside, right? As a byproduct, you will also enter heaven in the afterlife. So heaven in the afterlife is a byproduct of these religious practices, but not as the main reason. Let me repeat one more time. Paradise is not a place for people who have performed truckloads of prayers mechanically with no spiritual or ethical outcome. Paradise is a place for people who are morally upright and they do good deeds. So the first fruit of Ramadan is self-control or taqwa, which facilitates ethical behavior. This is a good criterion to judge our success in fasting. A lot of times people come to me and ask, how do I know whether God has accepted my fasting? How do I know whether God has accepted my prayers? Well, here you have the answer. The degree to which fasting will result in you having self-control, to that degree God has accepted your fasting. This is one of the criteria in order to judge the success in fasting. If after 30 days of fasting, I end Ramadan while my character flaws and my rotten behavior are still around, it means that my Ramadan was fruitless. It didn't have any fruit for me. Now let me talk about the second spiritual fruit of Ramadan. Heart and soul purification. So I invite you to think about these things. So when you fast, remember that you are fasting in order to purify your heart and your soul. So let me give you a little bit more information on that. Fasting has tremendous potential for cultivating and enriching our heart and soul. How? How can it do that? You see, fasting is a mild form of mortification. I know it's a mouthful, mortification. In Farsi, mortification is called riyazat. If I were to say it in Farsi language, ruzadari, no'i riyazat mu'tadil has. We Muslims often think that mortification or riyazat is something for the Hindus. Well, that's true. Mortification is very prominent in Hinduism, and they have some extreme forms of mortification. But fasting is actually a very mild form of mortification. Every single religion out there, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, and so forth, has some kind of mortification built into it. What is the idea in mortification? What do we try to accomplish? Well, the idea is that if we cater to our body, our soul will suffer. The idea in mortification is, if you exclusively cater to your body, its requirements, its needs, your soul will end up suffering. But if we slim down on the attention given to our body, then our soul will flourish. So there is an inverse relationship to the requirements of the soul and the body. As Christians would say, if you want your soul and your spirit to flourish, you must control the desires of the flesh. In fact, this is exactly what we do in Ramadan. We deprive our body of many comforts and many pleasures from sunrise to sunset. Isn't that what we do? We deprive our body of these comforts. We refrain from consuming food, from drinking, from smoking, so on and so forth. Now, I submit to you, this is a tough pill for the modern folks to swallow. I don't know how many of you have been told that it's some kind of nonsense for you to punish your body. I've been posed by this question so many times from my co-workers. Once I tell them that actually I don't, you know, eat or drink from sunrise to sunset, they tell me, why do you want to cause physical discomfort? This flies in the face of our modern upbringing. You see, modern lifestyle is all about comforts, right? The metaphor I can give you is the lazy chair. See, that's what the modern lifestyle is all about. I guess, you know, this presentation hopefully will tell you why some religious folks, thinkers, scholars have issues with modern lifestyle. Because modern lifestyle is all about comforts. Why do you work so hard? Why do you just work from 7 a.m. to God knows 10 p.m. every day? Because you want to have more money. Why do you want to have more money? Well, because you want to have more comforts in life. You want to live a more comfortable life, right? But then comes Ramadan, and suddenly you take the opposite path. You intentionally cause discomfort for your body. Have you thought about that? That's exactly what you do. That's exactly what you do. Now, we Muslims are not here to punish our bodies. We are here to punish the forces and the influences that impede our spiritual progress. The forces and influences that impede our moral improvement. That's what we are trying to do. Rumi has some illuminating analogies to make this point really clear. The first analogy, برنمد چوبی که آن مرد زد برنمد آن را نزد برگرد زد. The blows of the stick with which a man beats a rock, he inflicts not on the rock, but on the dust in the rock. Those of you who are older and you were brought up in Iran, do you remember around Nowruz? People used to hang their rugs, their beautiful Persian rugs, and usually in the street. And they would actually beat the rug. You remember? Why? Rumi says, you're not beating the rug in order to punish it. You're beating the rug in order to dust it off. To take the elements that are alien to the rug out of it. Elements that devalue the rug. That's the whole point. That's what basically what we also do in Ramadan. The second analogy is sort of funny, but also to the point. Rumi tells the story of a man who was disciplining an orphan. He was disciplining an orphan. People objected to him. They told him, why are you abusing the kid? گفت چندان آن یتیمک را زدی چون نترسیدی ز قهر ایزدی. گفت او را کی زدم ای جان و دوست من بران دیدی زدم کو اندروست. Someone said to the man, "You struck that little orphan so many blows. How weren't you afraid of the divine wrath?" He, the striker, responded, "Oh dear friend, when did I strike him? I struck at the devil that is in him." He said that, "I am not being hard on the boy. I'm very hard on the evil that resides in him. I'm disciplining him, but I'm not showing anger at him." Well, I'm not saying that when you go home, beat your kid, obviously, right? So don't do it on my account. It's just an analogy, right? The moral of story, according to Rumi, is this. We also need to beat on the impulses of the ego. You need to beat it. You need to be hard on your ego. We need to beat down on our cravings for pleasures. It is only after that we can reform our character. You want to have a better personality in life? You want to have a better character? Guess what? You have to beat down on some pleasures, on some things that you really crave for. You have to practice inhibition. Now, during Ramadan, we take the spotlight away from our body and we shine that light on our soul. We pause and reflect on our sins, our character flaws, on our shortcomings, as I mentioned in great detail last night, those of you who were here. We strive to reform ourselves. Let me share a really beautiful story from Rumi's Masnavi that illustrates the importance of character reform, which is part and parcel to Ramadan. This is a really beautiful story that tells us why is it so important for us to really work on our ego, work on building a more ethical and spiritual character. Here is the story. The fasting month of Ramadan came around at the time of the second caliph, Umar. After a month of fasting, a group of people ran to the top of a nearby hill to see the new moon and celebrate Eid al-Fitr. One man said to the caliph, Umar, "Look, here is the new moon." As hard as Umar looked, he didn't see the moon. But when Umar looked at the man's face, he noticed that a strand of hair from his eyebrow was hanging in front of the man's eye. Umar said to the man, "Wet your hand and rub it on your eyebrow, and then look up towards the new moon." The man did that. He rubbed his hand on his eyebrow. Then he looked at the skies and told Umar, "There is no moon. It has disappeared." Now, Umar said to the man, "Goft ari, muye abru shod kaman, suye to afkan tiri az gaman." "Yes, the hair of your eyebrow had become curved like a bow and shot at you an arrow of illusion." Can you follow the story and where he's going with it? Now Rumi throws in the punchline. چون که مویی کج شد او را راه زد تا به دعوی لاف دید ماه زد موی کج چون پرده گردون بود چون همه اجزات کج شد چون بود. When one hair became crooked, it hindered the man from seeing truly, so that making a false claim, he boasted to have seen the moon. Inasmuch as a crooked hair veils the sky, how will it be when all your members are crooked? Well, such a beautiful story. In other words, what will happen if I have a crooked soul? I have a crooked heart, and I have a crooked personality. What Rumi is saying is this: if you have distortions inside, you will see distortions outside. That's what he is trying to say. if you have an impure heart, you will project your impurities outside. The ugliness that we often see outside is nothing but a projection of the ugliness inside. That's why it's so critical to reform our own self. We should not rush to reform the outside world. These days, I see a lot of Muslim youth are so jazzed up to go out there and make this world such a wonderful place. And I always tell them, not so fast, my friend. You need more reformation than the world. Believe me, do not attempt to change the world before you change yourself. That's the moral of the story. That is the story of Ramadan. Look at the Middle East today. Why are Muslims in such a mess? It's because the great majority of them, before embarking on self-reformation and self-improvement, they aspire to reform the world. It doesn't work that way. Reform should always start with our own self. Ramadan, brothers and sisters, provides an opportunity for reform. This is what we should engage in during Ramadan, reforming our character and our soul. So now let me talk about the third fruit of Ramadan. Ramadan and spiritual transformation. The relation of Ramadan and spiritual transformation is a very fascinating one, and one that is a little bit tough to grasp, I admit. So bear with me as I develop it for you, okay? I'm going to start off with giving you an example. A successful example of having a good Ramadan which ended up in a spiritually transformed personality. And I'm going to give you the example of the Prophet Muhammad himself. The Prophet Muhammad is a very good example, an exemplary figure for how Ramadan can lead to spiritual transformation. As you know, the first verses of the Holy Quran were revealed to the Prophet Muhammad in Ramadan. The Quran is very explicit on that. In chapter 2, verse 185, the Almighty says, شهر رمضان الذي أنزل فيه القرآن. The month of Ramadan in which was revealed the Quran. So, there is definitely a relation, a connection between Ramadan and revelation of the Quran. The $1 million question is, what is the nature of this relationship? The vast majority of Muslims believe, or at least they understand, that there is a historical connection between Ramadan and Quranic revelation. What does that mean, historical relation? It basically means that God wanted to send a messenger to enlighten people. So he picked the Prophet Muhammad, right? So he picked a person, then he needed to pick a time to start his revelation. Well, suddenly God chose Ramadan, right? So accidentally, God chose Ramadan in order to reveal the first verses to the Prophet Muhammad. That, by and large, is the classical understanding of the relationship between Ramadan and revelation. I'm here to tell you that that's not the case, as I mentioned in some detail last night. The relation of Ramadan and revelation is causal, not historical. There is a cause and effect relationship between the two. The practices the Prophet Muhammad engaged in before his mission started led to the revelation of the Quran. So there was a cause and effect. As I mentioned last night, the Prophet used to have annual retreats in a cave near Mecca, Ghar-e Hira. at least for a month, according to histories, the Prophet used to have to take a retreat in that cave. We don't know exactly what practices the Prophet engaged in during his retreat, but we know that his long periods of retreat, reflection, meditation, and mortification ultimately paid off. His heart and his soul had been purified. They were readied in order to receive the Lord's angel. It was in the month of Ramadan when he received the first Quranic revelation. Later on, the Prophet Muhammad shared his secret with his followers. Many of the practices we engage in Ramadan were the practices the Prophet used to engage in before his mission started, right? They predated Islam, in a sense. The Prophet told his followers that these practices can also make your heart and your soul clean and make them receptive to divine inspiration and divine uplifting. So if you do those practices diligently and with a good mindset and good understanding of the philosophy behind them, you will also receive inspiration from the Lord. You will also experience a moral and a spiritual uplifting. Rumi has great insights on this aspect of Ramadan. Let me share with you some of his teachings. So bear with me as I develop this. So here Rumi wants to teach us how we can use Ramadan, the practices in Ramadan, in order to have divine, ultimately divine inspiration. Right? How can we cultivate our heart in order to receive divine inspiration and uplifting? Rumi starts off by saying that we human beings have senses. We all agree on that, right? At the minimum, we have 5 physical senses. We have hearing, the sense of hearing, sight, touch, smell, and taste. Rumi goes on to say that our senses are not limited only to these 5 physical or bodily senses. We also have inner senses, senses that are inwardly. Panj hissis juzin panj his, antu zarre surkhu in hisha chumis. Beside these 5 physical senses, there are 5 spiritual senses. These latter senses are like red gold, while those physical senses are like copper. So he's basically comparing our inner and our physical senses and tells us that our inner senses are far more valuable. You see, with our bodily senses, we learn about the physical world, the material world. We discover the physical world, right? That's what we do in sciences. We use our senses in order to make science. Rumi tells us that we also have inner senses. With these inner senses, we can learn about, we can discover the spiritual world. حس دنیا نردبان این جهان حس دینی نردبان آسمان. The worldly sense is the ladder to this world. The religious sense is the ladder to heaven. Sometimes Rumi uses the inner senses and religious and spiritual senses interchangeably, right? So he basically tells us that prophets and mystics have some extra senses that the average person is not aware of. I repeat, unaware. Not that he or she doesn't have it. The average person falsely understand that her only senses are these 5 bodily senses. Rumi says that prophets and mystics have very strong, very sharp religious or inner senses, which enables them to explore the hidden realm of existence. As I mentioned last night, those of you who are familiar with the Holy Quran, the Quran informs us of two dimensions to existence. عالم الشهاده و عالم الغیب, right? So عالم شهاده is the physical world, the material world that we can understand and explore with our five physical senses. But beyond the physical realm is the supernatural realm. If you want to explore that realm, you have to have other senses. Rumi says the prophets and mystics are equipped with those supernatural senses that they can explore the other realm of existence. Thanks to the religious and spiritual senses, prophets and mystics can see scenes, can see sights other people cannot see. They can hear voices and speeches that other people cannot hear. The critical point is this. Practices such as fasting sharpen our inner senses. That's the moral of the story. Fasting can sharpen our inner and religious senses. It is here that Rumi says these very famous poems that Iranians usually break their fast every day listening to these verses on radio. In dahan basti dahani baz shud کو خورنده لقمه های راز شد گرز شیر دیو تن را وابری در فتام او بسی نعمت خوری. If you close your bodily mouth, another mouth will open, which becomes an eater of the morsels of spiritual mysteries. If you cut off your body from the devil's milk, by thus weaning it, you will enjoy much bliss. So, we have an outer mouth, but we also have an inner mouth, right? With our outer mouth, we eat food that will nurture our body. With our inner mouth, we eat food that nurtures our soul, right? As simple as that. But Rumi says there is an inverse relationship between these two mouths. An inverse relationship. If you close one, the other one will open, right? Isn't that what you do during Ramadan? You close your mouth, your outer mouth, in order to eat less and less of food for your body. But guess what? Your inner mouth will open. So what do you eat with your inner mouth? We also have two types of food. We have morsel of bread and morsel of light. لغمه نور و لغمه نان. لغمه نور و لغمه نان. With the morsel of bread, you nourish and you nurture your body. With the morsel of light, you nurture and nourish your soul. There is an inverse relationship also between these two types of food. The less you consume of one, you crave more of the other one. In other words, if you crave more for bodily food, you will crave less for soul food. And it is here that Rumi says the following: نیست غیر نور آدم را خورش از جزان جان نیابد پرورش زین خورش ها اندک اندک باز بر که این قضای خر بود نه آن هر تا قضای اصل را قابل شوی نغمه های نور را آکل شوی. Man has no food but the light. The soul doesn't obtain nourishment from anything but light. Little by little, cut yourself off from these material foods, for these are the nourishment for an ass, not that of a free, noble man. So that you may become capable of absorbing the original nourishment and may eat habitually the morsels of light. So this is really the story of Ramadan. Consume fewer morsels of bread, so you can crave more for morsels of light. Now, morsels of bread is nothing but a metaphor. What is morsel of bread a metaphor for? It is a metaphor for pleasures, for materialism, for luxury, for extravagance, for fads and fashion. The more you crave for these things, the less you crave for light and enlightenment. As simple as that, right? As simple as that. I want to emphasize that Rumi is not theorizing here. He actually followed this path to enlightenment himself. He actually practiced what he was preaching. That is how he was transformed from an average jurist, an average mosque preacher, an average religious teacher, to becoming the world's most renowned spiritual master. As I mentioned before, of all the religious practices in Islam, Rumi loved, enjoyed, and benefited the most from fasting. It was through fasting that gates of light and enlightenment were opened on Rumi. So let me close my presentation with 3 points. If you haven't taken anything from my talk tonight, please take these 3 points with you, because that's the essence of what I was trying to share with you tonight. Point number one, the yardstick for a successful Ramadan is character transformation and spiritual rejuvenation. To make sure everybody got it, let me say it also in Farsi. میزان و شاخص روزداری کامیاب چیست؟ ما چطوری میتونیم بفهمیم که خداوند روزه ما رو پذیرفته، طاعات و عبادات ما رو پذیرفته؟ شاخص و میزانش بسیار آشکار و ساده است. تحول باطنی و شخصیتی. با این ترازو ما باید قبولی طاعات و عباداتمون رو بسنجیم. The second point. True fasting is not just about starving our stomach, but starving our carnal soul. In Ramadan, you are trying to starve your ego, not just your stomach. Again, in Farsi. روزه گرسنه نگه داشتن نفس هست، نه شکم. روزه گرسنه نگه داشتن نفس هست و نه شکم. Thirdly, fasting is not about losing weight, as a lot of people think it is. Fasting is not about losing weight, but losing vices. Vices such as wickedness, lying, backbiting, hatred, bigotry, jealousy, anger, arrogance, greed, cruelty. روزداری خواهران و برادران برای کاهش وزن نیست، برای کاهش معاصی، زشتی ها و پلیدی هاست. Therefore, if I fast for 30 days in Ramadan, but at the end I am still selfish and arrogant, if I still lie and trample over the rights of others, if there is no love, no compassion in my heart, what does it say? It says that my share of Ramadan was nothing but thirst and hunger. I did not reap any spiritual fruits or benefits from my fasting. Well, I appreciate your coming here tonight, paying attention to what I had to share with you, and I hope that this lecture was of some value, especially to the younger folks in the audience. Thank you very much, and God bless you all.